So I was 4 years old in 1963, and my family moved to Athania Street in Aspen Hill, Maryland, on a little cul-de-sac dotted by eight homes. Each one was 1,200 square feet and made affordable by the GI Bill for people returning from World War II and also the Korean War. My father was a Korean War veteran, and he was able, for the whopping price of $10,000, to buy one of these little houses on this little cold, quiet cul-de-sac for $10,000. Anyway, my family had moved there, and if we go forward in time, CBS News did a story on 1963, looking back in history, and they dubbed 1963 to be the year that everything happened. In 1963, Beatlemania took over America on all the airways. A guy named, a musician named Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan had just released his album with a song called Blowing in the Wind. And that would become the anthem for a whole generation of baby boomers that were just coming of age. In 1963, Martin Luther King stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and to a crowd of 250,000 people, he delivered his iconic speech, "I Have a Dream." And in that same year, the youngest president ever in our history, the 35th president of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was assassinated. He was a champion for civil rights, but he also, maybe less known, before he passed, he made a speech, his own iconic speech, to Congress and the world, pronouncing that America would land a man safely on the moon and bring him back to Earth. It was a year in 1963 of civil unrest and social injustice. And in that time period, it was sort of this calmness that it was sort of a time when people had this live for today attitude. And in that period, parents often let their children, you know, go outside and travel even long distances unaccompanied by adults. It was a great time to grow up as a kid. And it was never more true than on a little cul-de-sac in Aspen Hill, Maryland, called Athania Street. So with that backdrop, it was a brisk morning in the fall of 1963. The parents on Athania Street had a certain psychological comfort in knowing that their children could venture out and play under the watchful eyes of neighbors. So my brother Stephen and I, Stephen was five and I was almost four, we ventured out. And as we ran to the end of our little cul-de-sac, and we came to the white picket posts that were the boundaries between our little street and the grounds of the Mary Magdalene Church, we stepped onto the green grassy field, and it was our adopted playground. And as I looked to my right, as far as my eyes could see, was the second oldest and the fifth largest pet cemetery in America. Over 50,000 pets were buried there, including 70 horses and hundreds of frogs and turtles and rabbits and thousands of cats and dogs with names like Fluffy and Jigs and Rags. And yes, my brother Stephen and I, we would sometimes play among the tombstones, but not on this morning. And as we kept running on the left side of the field, the length of the field was a tall fence that stretched the length of the field. And at the very far end was the towering Mary Magdalene Church. And Stephen and I came to a stop in the middle of the field to probably the most our favorite place in the world. It was an old apple tree. And I stood there looking up as my brother Steve, for the first time, climbed onto that first branch. It had only been a year earlier that my oldest brother, Marty, climbed into this tree. And as I sat there looking at my brother on this branch, straddling the branch, pretending he was a flying ace, and my eyes went beyond Stephen and well into the canopy of the tree, as I imagined the path that I would take when I was just a few inches taller. And Stephen looked down from the branch and he yelled, "I'm hit, I'm hit." And I have to parachute out, and I stepped back as Stephen tumbled into a pile of leaves. And Stephen and I both laughed as he brushed himself off, and then he said, "I'll race you." And we started heading across the field, kicking up acorns and leaves. And as we approached the far side of the field, it was Stephen who noticed it first. There was a small hole in the fence, but it was big enough for two children, five and four, two little boys, to crawl through. And I could still hear the echo of my mom in my head, "Stay in the field, don't go out of the field." But the allure was too great for any little children with any sense of adventure. And a minute later, we were on the other side of the fence. And as you looked along the stretch of the fence, at the base of the fence was a little pathway, maybe 2 feet wide. And the pathway sloped down, not so gently, to a hill that ran another 6 to 8 feet. And that reached the top of a cement wall that dropped another 15 to 20 feet to the asphalt alley below. The alley separated the wall from the Aspen Hill, back of the Aspen Hill Shopping Center, which was a little strip center back then, on the other side of the alley. So Stephen and I sat there looking at this site. It was eerily quiet. And then my brother Steve broke the silence. "I'll race you." And we're off and running along the base of the fence. And I don't know whether it was an untied shoelace or whether it was a stump or whether I was just 4 years old, but I found myself sliding down the hill. And I was grabbing on the grass, and then I was sailing over the wall. And the first thing to hit was my top of my skull, right across here, and it cracked. And my brother Steve stood at the top of the wall looking down at his little brother, laying motionless but conscious. And then the silence was broken. Way above Stephen on a telephone pole, the top of the pole, a man working for CMP Telephone Company, a linesman, sees me fall. And he yells to my brother, "Get your mother! Get your mother!" My brother was through the hole and running as fast as he could. And at the same time, the man reached into his toolbox and he pulled out a wire. And on one end was a little earpiece that he stuck in his ear. And the other were two clamps. And he literally clamped into the wire that stretched from the pole, and in no time at all, he was talking through a switchboard operator to Holy Cross Hospital. Now, Holy Cross Hospital had just opened that year, and they had several years of red tape. And if not for Holy Cross, I wouldn't be standing here tonight. The next closest hospital was too far. Now, why the man is talking to Holy Cross Hospital, as I slid over the wall, the back door of the shopping center, the strip center, opened, and an employee, a teenager, maybe 17 or 18, taking a break from work, happens to step into the alley. He sees me fall. He grabs a piece of cardboard that's leaning against the wall, and he runs towards me. He kneels down. He slides the cardboard under me. He takes his jacket off. He puts it over me. And then he sits there, and he calmly talks to me. He says, "Stay still. Don't move. Help is coming. You're going to be okay." And it was only a couple minutes when the ambulance came screaming around into the alley. Now, back in 1963... only 50% of the emergency transport vehicles were ambulances. The other 50% were funeral home hearse, flatbed trucks, and in some cases, maybe even just a station wagon large enough to hold a stretcher. The ambulance came to a screeching stop. The two attendants came running towards me carrying the stretcher. Now, back in 1963, we didn't have EMTs. They called them attendants because they literally just had a driver's license, a strong enough back to carry a stretcher, and maybe a basic first aid course by the American Red Cross. But the important thing was they had me in the ambulance. And my mother, she made it just in time to jump in, and we were off. Meanwhile, back at Holy Cross Hospital, there was some chaos. The emergency team knew I was coming, and they were preparing to meet me at the front. And then they realized that the surgeon was not in the hospital. He had left for the day, and somebody said, "He's in the back parking lot, and maybe we can catch him." So one of the team members ran through the corridors of Holy Cross out the back door and literally pulled the surgeon, Dr. John Lord, L-O-R-D, aptly named. They pulled Dr. Lord from the car. Now remember, back in 1963, they didn't have mobile phones. They didn't have pagers. We had those dial phones that you just one at a time that were tethered to a wall. If it had been a minute later, Dr. Lord would have been in his car and heading home, and I wouldn't be standing here today. Now, meanwhile, Dr. Lord's in surgery now, and the rest of the crew's in the front of the hospital, along with my father, because my father, who was called by a neighbor, ran every red light and was standing in front of the hospital when the ambulance pulled up to a stop, and my mom stepped out. And my mom and dad stood there and watched their young son taken straight into surgery. It would be many hours before Dr. Lord would appear. And when Dr. Lord came through the door, he looked at my parents, and in a solemn, quiet way, he wanted to prepare them for the worst. He said it was really serious. He said if your son was any older, his skull would have shattered. And if he was any younger, it would have caved in. He said, now, he was just the right age that it cracked. But unfortunately, a piece of skull was inside of his head, and it's pressing against his brain. And we had difficulty getting to the piece of skull. And I literally, he said, molded a piece of an instrument and was able to get the piece of skull and pull it in place. But I need you to understand, it's very unlikely that Brian will live. And if he does live, it's highly probable that he will be unresponsive in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Now, my mom and dad took a minute to take in the silence. And then a nurse came screaming down the hall. Dr. Lord, Dr. Lord, it's Brian, it's Brian. My mom didn't want to hear the rest of the sentence because she kind of knew what it meant. And so she ran down the hall past Dr. Lord and the nurse and ran into the room with the nurse and doctor behind her. And as she approached my crib, expecting the worst, she looked over the side of the crib, and I was laying in the crib, eyes wide open, two black eyes, and the words came out of my mouth, "Mommy, can we go home now?" Now, I'm grateful. That was 61 years ago, almost to the day. And I'm grateful for every day that I've had on this earth. And I'm particularly grateful for the man on the pole who had the presence of mind to plug in and call Holy Cross. He could have climbed down that pole. I would have not been here. The young boy in the alley, the teenager, 17, 18 years old, who stood by my side. If I had moved even a little bit, I wouldn't be here tonight. And certainly for the surgeon, Dr. John Lord, who literally had an inspiration during the surgery to mold that piece of tool to pull that skull from my brain. And so I've learned that even the smallest heroes, you know, large and small, the people, my neighbors, who prepared meals for my family and babysat my siblings, why, my mom tended to me. But even for all of us, all the heroes in our life that we know, or and they may know or not know, the things they've done, because even the smile from a stranger can change the trajectory of somebody's life. And my hope is that we're all inspired to know that we have the power to be the hero in somebody else's story. Thank you.